It's about the 20s and the essential violence of those years, and I want to take a very quick tour of some of the actual physical destruction. This is just on the Western Front. This is just things that you could see easily available. And Cam says that the slides now are available independently at the Mises Academy. So I am propped up technologically, I think every way that we can get me propped up, so maybe this will work. So I was just saying that these sites on the Western Front, these are recent photographs. This is at a place called the Haute Chevauchée, and these are taken recently, and the destruction is still there. People still find live shells all the time. Are we still having problems? Okay. This is the ossuary. That's the you might say the bone chamber at Verdun, where there are the remains of 130,000 French soldiers unidentified. And that's just one spot. That's not all the French unidentified troops, just from that battle. Tynecott Memorial to the Missing at Passchendaele in Belgium. The whole end of this thing, everything on this end of the burial ground is a memorial to the missing. But it's only one British memorial to the missing. There are actually several more. There are 11,000 missing. There are 9,000 people nearly who are not identified, their bodies not identified, and so forth and so on. This is the Flodslow German Cemetery at Dixmude, Belgium, and these are by that same Ketta Kollwitz who drew that picture of the children dying of hunger in Germany, the German painter, and her own son is buried right in front of a self-portrait that is Ketta Kollwitz and her husband. He was killed in the war, too. Turkish cemeteries in Turkey full of the dead, British cemeteries in Turkey, French cemeteries in Turkey. The largest American cemetery in military cemetery or any cemetery in Europe is the American military cemetery for the New Sargon sector, 14,000 and some odd graves. So you're talking about destruction of all kinds, a world dislocated by war, all over the world. Portuguese troops in the war, Portugal was in the war, Chinese labor battalions, Russian regiments. You get the picture here. But now I want to continue on to a topic that sometimes is really unknown, and that is that the war raged on still after World War I was over. In other words, if we just say, okay, well, so they weren't fighting on the Western Front and Eastern Front and these big, huge fronts, was there fighting? And the answer is, oh, yes, indeed. And I've just made a listing. I probably missed a few here. This is something you can do for yourself. I decided to leave out some smaller scrapes and whatnot. But in many of the wars that you see listed on this page, and I won't read them out for you, but in many of these wars, there were tens of thousands of people who died, and in many cases, more civilians than soldiers. And in many cases, the civilians were essentially fighting, because these were wars in which sometimes paramilitary groups were in charge. After the big guns stopped, the war continued on. And I didn't even list all the separate wars in China. China was at war from the teens on. In their numerous wars elsewhere. And this is just for the 20s, as you see, it doesn't include the 30s. So war raged on still, and there were all kinds of other ways in which we can talk about the violence of the interwar period, too. One is the violence of inflation. And in working on this this lecture, I just ran across a brand new study by a South African economist who's got some Austrian or Misesian connections, I believe, just as I found out by looking around the site of a company called EPM Analytics. Maybe some of you know it. It's in Johannesburg. And he's done a study about inflation in South Africa. And he's found out that the coincidence of inflation and violence for the longer period he studied in South Africa is just absolute. It's a slam dunk. Every time there's inflation, there's greater violence. And as he says, there may be legitimate political grievances, but the trigger for social conflict appears to be inflation. And of course, why not? I mean, it's theft. So people earn their money, and then they find out it's not as much as they thought. They find out that the government has, in fact, or somebody has stolen it. In most cases, understand it's the government that has done it. But their dollars are just apparently flying out the door. And of course, if people are frustrated, if there are grievances already, then this makes for terrible trouble. And I want to now go through some of the stages of the German hyperinflation. But please remember that there was inflation in all the belligerent countries. Everybody had inflation. And there was hyperinflation in Russia. We talked about a little bit last week, hyperinflation in the ruble. There was hyperinflation in Hungary, hyperinflation in Austria, and the big one, the German hyperinflation. Let me just make a few points here. We won't spend our whole time here, and we've got to talk more about inflation as we talk about the coming of the Depression next week. But first of all, the German inflation started not with the opening of the war, but a few months earlier. The German economic historian Wolfram Fischer made this connection very, very clear about 30 years ago, that as the Germans increased their armaments and started a huge, you get the picture here, a huge finance reform in the years 1911, 1912, then they started financing these armaments and the larger military establishment by means of inflation. But it was pretty small, and frankly, it was pretty small during the war years. The Germans actually kept their inflation a bit lower than some of the other belligerent powers on both sides. It was a major means of financing, but they also borrowed a lot of money in the form of 11 different war bond issues, and they did a lot of confiscating. As one of the German economic leaders said, this war has been great. We've come to a whole new definition of what it means to sequester money from individuals. Well, when the war front collapsed, the Weimar governments continued to, and in fact, increased their resort to inflation, because as we haven't talked much about yet, the Weimar government, though it had some liberal elements in it, was also a thoroughly social democratic government. In particular, not so much medical insurance, although there was Germany invented medical insurance. Bismarck kind of invented it in the 1880s, but it was mainly unemployment insurance, because the Social Democratic Party in Germany was basically an engine of the unions, and so above all they wanted unemployment insurance. And this is going to in the end break the Weimar Republic totally. There was a complete breakdown before Hitler took over, and that was it. But needing more money to cover the social insurance scheme, it's a little bit like Britain after the Second World War. They were out of money anyway, and then they installed the great welfare state, and in the midst of an economic crisis, to carry out the most expensive thing you can do besides war, that is to install a welfare system. That's not very smart. Oh, that sounds familiar to me in America today. Does it sound familiar to you? In any case, the Weimar Republic did install a kind of a welfare state, and the government relied more and more on inflation. And they couldn't rely on war bonds anymore, right? And so as they inflated more and more, and we're going to read more about this when we read the Bresciani Peroni book. I don't think that was this week, was it? So price began to zoom up. There's some evidence also that the Weimar government looked at the Allies and looked at this whole reparation payment issue and said to themselves, basically, we talked about this in the Q&A last week, but I'll repeat it again. Said basically, well, hey, if the Allies want to come take over our economy and smash us to the ground, let's leave them with a smoldering ruin. And so they did encourage, they even encouraged companies to make their own currency. So not only were was the government printing money, but the big companies, the big factories were printing out money and paying their people with basically monopoly money, and they just printed it out and paid them. I mean, it was a horrifically unjust, dishonest way to go about this. And so the Germans are, they're in on the whole. The German government is in on the whole thing. Else, how could their currency be inflated? But luckily, the bankers didn't think it was so bad. The head of the Reichsbank, Rudolf Hoppenstein, said, "Well, the impulse to monetary depreciation has always come from abroad. It's not our fault. It's pushed on us." And he talked often about, well, the so-called inflation. Well, right. I mean, it was so-called because it was inflation. A government shill, Professor Wolf. Wolf in 1922 wrote, "In proportion to need, less money circulates now than before the war. The circulation is now 15 to 20 times that of pre-war days, while prices have risen 40 to 50 times." So, I mean, you get the picture here. All this sounds familiar. All inflation regimes deny that there's inflation. All of them try to act like it's just happening out of the ether, that that the government has nothing to do with it, and that's because it's just theft on the part of the government. All we need is a single indicator, and you see these figures here from July 19. There was inflation that slowed down with the spending and all that, and then in 1922, after the reparations bill, the government kind of pulled out the stops, and here is the table showing prices of imported goods, cost of living, and so forth, and you can see how that goes up to June 1923, very horrendous level. Here are basically German banknotes being used as note paper, and I think that was probably one of the better uses of those of that paper money. There was so much of it. You saw the earlier photograph of the kids playing around with it. There's a million great photographs of the German inflation, what people were doing, stoking their fires with bundles of paper and whatnot. The German presses started taking in the old bills and overprinting those so that they would strike out 20 and make it 20 million or whatever, so that people began to talk of trillions of marks and whatnot, just absolutely unbelievable. In the area of manners and morals during inflation, so many things happen in an age of inflation. There's two good books I'd recommend, and in fact, let me just stick with one. Stenholz's book, The Age of Inflation, about manners and morals. But I would also point out in a non-economic book, and Stenholz is an Austrian economist. But I would also point out Otto Friedrich's unbelievably great portrait of Berlin in the 20s before the deluge, about the Weimar Republic. And I would you know, if you want a picture of all this, I mean, if you want to know where Marlene and Dietrich came from, and the whole live for today, the perfect example of time preference, where people said, well, you know what, our money's not even going to be here tomorrow, we might as well just blow it today. So you get Marlene and Dietrich in The Blue Angel. That's, of course, a movie made at the end of the 20s, just in the early 30s. You get all of these cultural kinds of things. There are some very interesting and, I think, individualist and, I think, heroic cultural productions from the Weimar Republic. But there is also this strain of these kinds of issues I show here, of greed, of murder. There's a whole strain of fascination with sex murder and whatnot. Cam mentions on the list just now Hans Falada's A Wolf Among Wolves. Falada also wrote a great novel about this period a little bit later in the Depression called Little Man, What Now? And I recommend the both of those novels. So you get a sense of where we're going. And again, it's just a simple matter of time preference. It's eat, drink, and be merry, because tomorrow our money is going to be worthless. And all these books I've mentioned show how this works. To some extent, this is going to be generalized in the Roaring Twenties and the Paris burlesque of the 20s and so forth. I don't want to take that too far, because I think culturally we can't paint that period as one single thing. But this strain, this strain of culture that comes from the eat, drink, and be merry kind of morals and manners, I think it's very, 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 very important, and a part of what the people I'm going to talk about briefly at the end of today's lecture were thinking of when they and basically kind of responding to. So the great crisis of the hyperinflation came in 1923. The Germans said, well, we've got this huge hyperinflation, we can't pay anymore, which really didn't make any sense, since they weren't paying in their bills anyway, and since the only people profiting besides profiteers close to the government was the government itself. And the Allies said, okay, you won't pay your reparations payment, so we'll occupy the Ruhr. Then the German government called for the workers to carry out passive resistance and to quit their jobs and go on strike. 130 civilians were killed by Allied occupying troops, especially the French. And in September, a reasonable politician, if there is such a thing, if that's not a kind of a contradiction in terms, a man called Gustav Stresemann declared a national state of emergency, the end of passive resistance, and he infuriated the nationalists by saying, "Look, we got to put things back together. It's not about German pride anymore. It's about German survival." In Saxony, in the midst of this great convulsive crisis of the Weimar Republic, the Reich intervened in Saxony to remove a communist socialist state government. The communists tried to seize power in Hamburg. An uprising was suppressed in October. A separate Rhine Republic was proclaimed in October. Now, that's a good thing, but it just shows you how things were kind of crumbling. And then, of course, early November, Hitler's beer hall putsch, that is his attempt to take over the government of Bavaria, failed, and Hitler was sent to prison. So this is the big crisis, but Stresemann is able to negotiate this crisis, and he employs the crafty abilities of the tycoon banker Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht. I love that name. Schacht's father was a banker and was working in New York when Schacht was born there in the 1880s or so. And so his father admired Horace Greeley. So his name was Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht. What a moniker. He became the currency a commissioner and was later then the head of the Reichsbank. He also became a Nazi supporter in the early 30s and helped form the economic policy of Hitler's regime, although he quit partway through all that. But here's what Schacht worked out. Schacht and Stresemann and others, they said, okay, well, here's how we'll do it. We'll get foreign backing. We'll basically hawk our railroad system, and we'll talk to the American bankers, the big bankers, and let them back you might call it a gold reserve standard, okay? Not going back to the gold standard. On the 23rd of November, 23, a paper mark was introduced, stabilized at 4.2 billion marks to the dollar, okay? And of the current paper mark. And then the so-called Rentenmark, which meant as a security mark or the loan mark, was issued by a bank called the Rentenbank, which mortgaged land and industrial goods worth about 3.2 billion marks and to back the new currency. Then, after a period that kind of cool down and stabilize. On the 30th of August 24th, a new currency, the Reichsmark, was established. Now, the humor magazine, the satirical magazine, Simplicissimus in Munich, had a famous cover for this. Stresemann was coming to power and finally attempting to do something, but the words below that skeleton are simply too late, and even though the rising sun of the mark is coming up, and that's a kind of famous magazine cover. And it was indeed too late for many. A whole class of savers had been wiped out. A whole class of debtors had their debts wiped out and were now doing pretty well. The society had been overturned. Everything everybody learned in kindergarten, so to speak, turned out not to be true. And it was, you might say, that the ground was laid for more violence. I mean, this was a violent intervention into society, and it absolutely left its mark on Germany for generations to come. So the Reichsmark came into being, and again, it ended up as a kind of fictitious gold standard, a gold exchange standard of the kind later set up in the United States and across the world. So there's violence there, all right? And I don't mean just street violence associated with the hyperinflation, but I mean there's a violence there in a kind of Bastiat-style plunder of people while they don't know it, and the ruination of their lives and the redistribution of wealth in that way. And I think that's very much a part of the dislocation and violence. And then we get recent studies from South Africa to show that this is what happens. I mean, violence increases. I wish we could see some studies for some periods in American life. That would also be interesting. And I don't know of it. Somebody probably does. Cam will probably post one, or Vangel will probably post one here in just a second, now that I've said it. I want to turn now to the violence of ethnic cleansing. It's a term we talked about a little bit last week, and I want to be just slightly more systematic. We don't have time to talk about it. I would like to give a six-week course on the ethnic problems of the 1920s sometime, but I don't think anybody wants to know quite that much about it, and I'm not sure I'm glad I do. So anyway, let me try to summarize this. And just in very, very brief, simplistic form, border changes plus nationalism are going to lead to ethnic cleansing. Because if you change a border and you imprison a minority from the other side, an ethnic minority, and if your government is aimed at identity politics of saying, well, the only good people in our country, the only people who belong in our country are Slavovians, and you're not a Slavovian, and so we have to get rid of you somewhere. We have to, we have to make policies that discriminate, or we have to drive you out, or we have to deport you, or we have to expel you, or we have to kill you. So that's what I mean. All the new states produced by the Paris Peace were products of hyper-nationalist thinking. And as I pointed out last week, our president, Woodrow Wilson, was one of the most important theorists of hyper-nationalism at that. He said self-determination. But if you read the minutes of the Council of Four and see how he explains self-determination to those guys, Clemenceau and Lloyd George, you will agree with me that when he says self-determination, he means that ethnic likes should be with ethnic likes, that like should be with like. And so so all the states produced, even the losers, the ones cut down, see, they were little now hyper-nationalist states, no longer big empires, no longer part of the Russian Empire, no longer part of the easygoing Austrian, Austro-Hungarian Empire, no longer Polish-speaking citizens of Prussia or Alsatian-speaking, French-speaking, so really just German dialect-speaking citizens of Alsace and Germany. Now, even the losers were violently nationalist, violently disappointed, super proud little nationalist republics, almost all of which became dictatorships within the next 6, 7, 8 years. Okay? Now, the winners received generous land from the defeated in every case. And so Austria and Hungary were deemed losers, and Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia and Romania were deemed winners. And so what happened was that land was given to those winners, and that meant that there were Austrian and Hungarian minorities in Slovakia and in Yugoslavia and so forth and so on. And so those minorities, everybody knew under the new regime, those minorities would be persecuted. The League of Nations passed a series of minority treaties and forced all these countries to sign the treaties in the mid-20s. But to tell you the truth, it's easy to sign a treaty. I mean, but all of the states, Poland, as I mentioned last time, had I'm about to mention it now. Poland was a country set up with so many lands from other groups around it that less than half of Poland was actually Polish. Now, let that settle for just a minute. You've got a hyper-nationalist state in the hands of a really rough nationalist, quasi-anti-Semitic party, a party that says, you know, being Catholic means being Polish, a party that is in charge of a government that attacks every single neighbor within the first 3 years of its existence, and it with as many neighbors as Poland has, Germany, Lithuania, the Soviet Union, Ukraine, Czechoslovakia, attacked all of them. So you're going to have problems. And then on the other side, the people whose minorities are in, say, Poland or Yugoslavia, then they want it back. In other words, there's that, you know, they want the minorities back. So this makes for problems. I mentioned Poland. Let's look at Czechoslovakia for just a second. I won't dwell on this, but Czechoslovakia was a brand new country. It was formed of a piece of Austria and a piece of Hungary. They were actually from 1867 on ruled by different governments within the Austrian Empire. So Austria and Hungary were autonomous parts of the same empire. And the Czech part, let's say a German and Czech part had been ruled by Austria, and the Slovakian part ruled by Hungary. And so if you look there on the western part of Czechoslovakia in this on this map, that part that's pink and purple, well, the pink parts, as you can see, are the Czech-speaking parts, and then the purple parts are the German-speaking parts. And then you've got Slovaks in the east, but a bunch of Ukrainians in the far east, and in the south, a lot of Hungarians. And some Poles scattered about in all of them. So here's the thing. There's 51% Czechs in the country. There's 22% Germans. There's 16% Slovaks. And so they decide to call this country Czechoslovakia. Now, you follow me here, right? You understand the joke. What's interesting is that even now, it's hard to find these statistics printed in the order that I've printed them across the top of this slide. I got these from the American Wikipedia, not from the European Wikipedia, but from an American Wikipedia, and they were printed in the order Czechs, Slovaks, Germans, Hungarians. You see? That justifies the name. So you build a country and say, okay, this is now Czechoslovakia, but of course there's way more Germans than Slovaks. But nowhere in the name is that German group recognized. So you can think of many examples. How, in other words, these two countries take over another one, and you just call it by the name of the two countries. That western part with the most Germans in, the crescent kind of part of that long amoeba-like state, that's the Sudetenland, which is going to cause so many problems throughout the interwar period. And in the run-up to World War II, it's going to end up in the demolition of Czechoslovakia, which we'll talk about later. But that's the famous Sudetenland. And we talk, because those hills there in the west are called the Sudeten Hills or the Sudeten Mountains. And so the Sudeten Germans lived there. So that's another one of these border issues. And the tensions were so high. There was discrimination against the German minority. Well, the Czechs discriminated against the Slovaks, too, and the Slovaks discriminated against the Hungarians, in spite of the minority treaty, just as in Poland, just as in Romania, just as in the other places. There's a whole other set of Middle Eastern border changes. I'm not going to deal with them this week because we just have too much. We just have too much to talk about in the rest of the lecture, and especially since the technical woes of the first part of this class have slowed us up. I'm glad I decided to do this. But there is an excellent article that came out just recently. And it's in Der Spiegel, and a Musician friend of mine pointed this out on Facebook just, I think, today. And so if you want to take a look at that, it's a wonderful summary of how the border changes in the Middle East led to the violent and destructive patterns of life in the Middle East in a place that had been, you know, by and large, over most of its parts, peaceful for 500 years previous. So we'll save the Middle East for one of the next classes, and we'll talk about that later. But that's an important element of this violence too. Now let me turn to the violence of the Bolsheviks, and that's a huge topic. And I've gone through this with some of you before in the totalitarian course, and in one of the other courses. So you'll forgive me, but we're going to go through it pretty rapidly, and I think that we are all pretty much on the same page on this anyway. I mean, to the groups who would take a Mises course, I don't really have to demonstrate that the Bolsheviks were bad guys. But let me just point out a few facts here that this is all well known, that we've there are many commentators while all this were happening. oftentimes people who had originally been pro-Soviet and then went there and found out the truth. Okay? Be like a famous folk singer, like, I don't know, somebody called Pete Seeger, who actually went to China while the killings were in progress in 1949 and just forgot to ask if anything was amiss in that country, in that communist regime he loved so well. It's okay. Pete Seeger realized 50 years later that he might have been wrong, that maybe Stalin was a cruel man after all. So the media hype about Pete Seeger's death is probably perfectly acceptable and fine. But he did leave a bunch of the Chinese propaganda songs in his repertoire until the very end, as I understand it. But a lot of people did turn around and say, golly, that's horrible. It's horrible what the actual regimes do as opposed to my theoretical devotion to communism and peace and whatever. Solzhenitsyn told us all about this in the Gulag Archipelago. That's the early 70s. Stefan Courtois and others and his friends told us all about this in the Black Book of Communism in the 90s. Robert Gelatoli, 3 or 4 years ago, wrote a wonderful book about this, about Lenin, Stalin, and Hitler. I recommend it. James Ryan has just come out with a book on Lenin's terror, and there are just dozens and dozens of other, even mainstream historical books, talking about the extent to which there is an inseparable doctrine of violence that goes along with Bolshevism, that goes along with Marxism-Leninism, and with Marxism itself, pre-Leninist Marxism. It has to do with the de-emphasis, the sweeping away of the importance of the individual. It has to do with the emphasis on the mass of people. It has to do with the need to do away with property and that core belief that an individual's property is an evil thing and that the individual ought to be punished. And this just goes right through the whole communist history. You know, we don't know the numbers these days. You hear some different numbers actually, but a moderate number. And isn't it enough to condemn it? Would 20 more million make any difference? 100 million is just absolutely unbelievable. It makes this fact alone makes the 20th century the most violent century in recorded history. But it doesn't stop there. The communists, the Bolsheviks, beginning with Lenin and then with Stalin especially, carried out vast ethnic cleansing. And so what was unleashed from World War I, the communist regime that managed to come to power during World War I in Russia and then later it tried to come to power elsewhere in numerous different countries and eventually took hold in China and then, of course, across Eastern Europe and many other places. There was vast ethnic cleansing. Stalin is the greatest ethnic cleanser in the history of the world. And there's more. The Bolsheviks started immediately at the behest of Lenin killing prisoners. And this immediately caused the white forces in the Civil War to kill them back. In other words, I'm trying to figure out here how the violence started, and the Bolsheviks were so integral to the production of this massive violence in the 20th century that you have to understand all the ways in which they did it. But one of the ways was that in these wars, they were so horrifically violent in killing prisoners and hostages and whatnot that others started doing it too. Even though those elements were there, everybody was spurred on to do it. Torture as well. The communists were, and we know this from the Courtois book, and there are some horrible photographs in that book about tortures. that these communist commissars in the early days in 1918, 1919, were just thinking up, you know, what can I do just to torture and to show people that we're the boss? Well, there was the mass starvation. There was the horrific crime that killed maybe 10 million people alone in Ukraine and along the Volga and Belarus and all the places. There's mass rape that the Soviet armies were encouraged. We have the leaflets. We know that they were encouraged to not just to plunder, but to rape women. And the largest mass rape of that anybody knows about in history was in Germany in 1945. But make no mistake, this happened everywhere. It happened in Poland. There was a mass rape in Hungary, Romania. And this mass rape also includes Russian women liberated from German concentration camps. So the Russian soldiers liberated those camps and then raped them. I mean, we're talking about violence of armies on an unprecedented level. And it's certainly true that armies have always been violent and that they've always raped and pillaged. And there are some pretty big atrocities. I mean, the state is the state, right? That's, as Mises said, it's all violent. These cases go far beyond anything else that we know about, except a few cases of the Japanese, of course, the massacres carried out on the other side of the world, and we'll talk about that in a different connection. So there's all of that. I want to also mention, and just briefly, especially since we're running out of time, but or a little bit short on time today. But I want to mention terror and provocation. The issue of provocation is really, really important in the 20th century. And I think the lineage of provocation really starts with the 19th century in a big way. Provocation is simply that process of starting violence, enhancing hatred, getting your own side to become victims in some way, in order to get everybody fired up to hate the enemy. We get the term agent provocateur from this, an agent provocateur. And I think the principle was really pretty much laid out by the Tsarist, the secret police, the Okhrana, in the old days, 1880s, 1890s, after the assassination of Tsar Alexander II. And they certainly used it. In other words, the vast statist Russian Empire certainly figured out how to do this. It's quite likely that the 1905 revolution, which started when there was a march in the Winter Palace led by one Father Gapon, all the scholars now think that Father Gapon was an Okhrana agent. So it was a provocation. Draw the people out. Get them to show themselves. Then get the Tsarist troops to in response to fire on them, and boom, you have what you have a revolution. So this principle that the Okhrana used, the Bolsheviks learned to use continually, and then it became generalized, and now it's used all over the world. It's used by every state. I mean, every state says, "Oh, that's a great thing." I mean, the Germans started World War II by provocation. They went and killed everybody in a radio station on the Polish border and then staged it to make it seem that the Poles had done it. So everybody's doing it. But I think that the Bolsheviks are, you might say, the cultural transmitters of the process of provocation. And it's worth a lot more study, too, I would say. Mises said of Lenin and the communists, the real significance of the Lenin Revolution is to be seen in the fact that it was the bursting forth of the principle of unrestricted violence and oppression. It was the negation of all the political ideals that had for 3,000 years guided the evolution of Western civilization. And I think this is so crucial that we think about civilization as in the way that Mises did, as the opposite of violence, as living your life, producing whatever it is you produce, exchanging that with other people, living this peaceable and non-aggressive life. And I think that is just so crucial here in the midst of our world. And I think our subject here proves that once again. So let me talk a little bit about the violence of hyper-nationalist socialists, okay? I put a bunch of fascist symbols up here. You know, it was not just the fascist party and the Nazi party, but a lot of countries had fascist parties. The Falange in Spain called itself a fascist party. The Arrow Cross Party, that's the symbol down at the the Falange is on the bottom left, and then that odd-looking flag with the cross made out of arrows, that's the Arrow Cross Party. Everybody has some kind of weird symbol. The Iron Guard in Romania, that's the one on the green field. The Fascist is, of course, the symbol of the whole name of the fascist party, and then, of course, there's the Nazi flag. And then I have Hitler up there with his pal Mussolini. I don't know that they're all fascists in the most technical sense. Probably they are. There's also a Lebanese. Oh, that picture covered up the. Yeah, there's a Lebanese Falange party that copied the Spanish one and came to power in 1936. Cam says the tic-tac-toe party. Well, that's a good point. You know, you play a pretty good game there. But Lebanon had also a fascist party. They're all hyper-nationalists. They're all socialists. Mussolini came to power. He was a committed socialist. He was, we've discussed this in great detail. We spent a lot of time in the totalitarian course going through the biography and history of Mussolini. He was a correspondent of Lenin. He was on the left. He was the editor of the main socialist newspaper in Italy, which was a radical Bolshevik-oriented paper. And then he went to war and got converted to hyper-nationalism. So he applied the same socialist principles to nationalism, invented corporatism, or a new kind of invented it, brushed it up from older versions. And so he's a socialist, all right? Same way with the other movements. They're all collective. They're all collectivist mass organizations that rely on us and them, rely on us being some big, huge, coherent group, and them being the dangerous other sorts of people. So these are very, very violent parties, and especially in the case of these fascist parties, I would say they're not violent on the level of both of them, but they were ready to dish out plenty of it. They were immediately, with the founding in 1919, talking about, you know, how violence can solve problems and so forth. Well, we discussed in the totalitarian course how Mussolini drew on earlier left anarchist and syndicalist doctrines of especially the writings of George Sorel, S-O-R-E-L, who said, you know, violence is you know, the danger of violence is overrated. Violence can really help you solve some problems. And so Mussolini drew on that type of thing, and all of these hyper-nationalist leaders, Hitler, Mussolini, the Hungarians, all the Falangistas, they all talk all the time about the bold, ruthless move. You do things ruthlessly. You carry out the bold task. And half the time they were talking about some kind of violent task as well. So let's think about Hitler now in this context. Hitler was this Austrian guy who we now know was initiated into a hyper-social Darwinist, anti-Semitic group of folks in Austria before the war. And he moved to Vienna, where his mother died of cancer under the knives of two Jewish surgeons, and that didn't help matters much. He was living at Vienna at a time with an official anti-Semitic party, and he was an advocate of kicking out the many Jews who were coming to Vienna from the Russian Empire, where the Russians were treating him horribly. So he went to war, was decorated a few times. There is much debate still over his role in the war, whether he was just another doughty World War One soldier, or whether he was in fact a runner, because that was a little bit safer job, and he was able to become more friendly with his officers. There's a book on him that you should at least take a look at or read some reviews of. I've read the book. It's called The Hidden Hitler, and by a very fine German historian about some possibilities of Hitler's pre-war and wartime personal activities. But in any case, he found that he was in the army intelligence after the war. He was supposed to infiltrate groups, and he infiltrated this little party of hyper-nationalist, anti-Semitic crackpots, the DAP. It was one of the many front groups of, somebody mentioned in the forum the other day, the Thule Society, or the Thule in German, the Thule Society, and a hyper-nationalist group. And this was a one of the many associated groups with that. And he went into this little party to infiltrate it and found that he thought it was a good idea, that he could speak well, that he could influence people. And so he took it over and converted this from the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, the German Workers' Party, to the National Socialist German Workers' Party, the Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei. And our term Nazi is just simply a kind of abbreviation of the type that the Germans used in the 20s. A lot of Germans in the 20s called the socialists the Sozis, and from the Sozialistische, Sozialdemokratische Partei, Sozi, and the National Sozialistische Partei, those people they call, and it's a big name, so they call them Nazis. Today in Germany, not many people use the term Nazi, partly because it sounds a little too friendly. So they say NS or the Hitler movement, or they use some other terminology. But in any case, Nazi's a valid term from the time. And he converted this little group into a party and tried to make it a stronger party, leagued together with other nationalist, super nationalist parties, and tried to take over the Bavarian government. Was in stopped in the streets by the Bavarian state police. That was November 1923, at the height of the crisis, this crisis of the Weimar Republic. And then he was, the movement was broken up in the street, shots were fired, his friends were killed, he was put in jail, but it was a very genial confinement, and there wrote Mein Kampf. And he put his friend Rosenberg, a kind of crackpot, in charge while he sat and planned how to do the next thing. He figured you couldn't take it over by violence because, it had just been proven. If the state has all the guns, then the state has all the guns. And in the Weimar Republic, the state did enact gun control. And if you want to read a slam dunk book about this. You know, there's been this kind of debate back and forth between those opposed to gun control, those for gun control, and those opposed to gun control say, well, they had that in Germany and Hitler was able to take over easily. And the people on the left say, oh, you know, that's just a myth. Well, it's not a myth anymore. A new book put out by the Independent Institute, Stephen Halbrook book, slam dunk. I've read it. It's there's no doubt about it. He goes into the archives and I'll say this for an American attorney who's been mostly concerned with constitutional issues in this country. He did a great job making his way through those archives, and it's just not an open question anymore. I mean, he's solved that question. So anyway, the Weimar Republic was on the way to controlling weapons, and then the Nazis just simply almost immediately started cracking down. And you know, the first people they took the weapons from were the Jews, because they said, well, they're the enemies of the state, you know. Whatever we do with them later, we want to take them down. So you can go read that a brand new book. It's I recommend it home. So Hitler said, well, you know, we don't have the guns, and the state's always going to have the drop on you that way. So you got to go in by politics. And he created several different plans, several different ways to appeal to first the people in the countryside. He thought, well, they'd be more likely to listen to our ideas. And then he switched over in the late 20s to an urban plan. And this fit the Depression years better, because it was in the cities that the people were most impacted, right? I mean, on the farm, they could always, eat something. They would eat something that was growing. But in the cities, there was extreme privation in Germany because of the Depression. And that was his idea. He thought all along that we need fully engaged. We need people who are a real cadre. We need people to be Nazi Party members who will give it everything. And he scheduled event after event after event. This was by design. Marches and speeches and demonstrations and more meetings and working on uniforms and sewing boots or whatever. But he made this whole program for Nazi Party members in the 20s so that they would be totally devoted members. And those were the people later called the old fighters. Once he took over, you know, all kinds of people joined just to get advantages of being a Nazi. But the old fighters were those people who had worked their fingers to the bone to get the Nazis in power. Although it's also true that after 4 years of working on these different plans, by 1928, Hitler got fewer votes in 1928 than he did in 1926. So he doesn't make much progress until the Depression, and then we have to talk about that as we go. So that's the real issue. Now, so we got Mussolini and Hitler and the Bolsheviks, these ideological dictatorships, and then I haven't even, you know, we don't even really give much attention usually to the other dictatorships that sprang up in Europe. That's why, if you read that article I wrote on Mises Daily before the course where I quoted that Fred Astaire song, I've always thought that was really funny, that dictatorships were so much in the air that Fred Astaire was singing about them. And the New York songwriters were writing funny songs about, well, dictators would be better if they had zoom on their bass fiddles now and then. So it was just a thing. You can find that running through a lot of popular culture, that the dictator became a kind of stock character, because so many European countries started out as the successor states of the empires, new democracies, new republics, and then within 4, 5, 6 years, they were just garden variety functional dictatorships with heavy-handed supranationalist governments, imposing kind of versions of the German wartime Hindenburg program on their populations, and basically looting their population so that they could buy more tanks and more weapons and whatnot. And that's the picture of these dictatorships. I haven't even listed them all. I started to list them. I thought that's going to take a while. Poland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Yugoslavia, you got it. It's a lot of dictatorships. Let me turn now to Mises and the issue of violence. I mean, I've already listed one of his comments, but there's a couple of important things that he wrote at this period in his books, in his book Liberalism, and then how he put this later in his notes and recollections. Sorry about that text there. I don't know how that happened, but in any case. Mises, in talking about the period in Austria, remember this whole history we went over last week. Austria falls apart. It looks like socialist revolution. And then the Bolsheviks threaten to take over. But Mises knew from his days at the University of Vienna, he happened to know Bauer. Remember, he said he persuaded Bauer not to give in to the Bolsheviks, and yet Bauer always hated him for it. Okay? So here's what Mises said in his recollections later on. I knew what was at stake. In a few days, Bolshevism in Vienna would have created starvation and terror. Plundering hordes would soon have roamed the streets of Vienna, and in a second bloodbath would have destroyed the remnants of Viennese culture and civilization. Now, soon after these events, here's what Mises wrote. From the standpoint of 1927 or 28, if I'm not mistaken, we wrote in Liberalismus. It cannot be denied that fascism and similar movements aiming at the establishment of dictatorships are full of the best intentions, and that their intervention has, for the moment, saved European civilization. The merit that fascism has thereby won for itself will live on eternally in history. But though its policy has brought salvation for the moment, it is not the kind which could promise continued success. Now, this is a passage we should get out in the open. I mean, critics often say, oh yeah, look, he was in favor of fascism. But I mean, if you get to the central part of what he says, he thinks that in Italy and in Austria to some extent and other places, that the communists were prevented from taking over by these fascist parties. And in the end, the fascists were not, as he said, a party that could continue success. Why? Because they were statist, because they didn't respect private property. Because in the end, and this comes from Mises' book, Liberty and Property, in the end, he says, the government is the opposite of liberty. Any government is the opposite of liberty. It is beating, imprisoning, hanging. Whatever a government does is ultimately supported by the actions of armed constables. If the government operates a school or a hospital, the funds required are collected by taxes, that is, by payments exacted from the citizens. So for Mises, the core element of civilization was the respect for property. And these fascist regimes couldn't live with that. Now, he thought that temporarily, in the heat of the moment, great, you know, stop the communists from tearing the whole thing apart, because there was clearly a difference between this seems crazy, but a moderate police state and the Bolshevik Revolution and horrific memory and millions of murders and all that. There's clearly a difference in that, and anybody would have to recognize that. And given the choice, you know, that's what he's saying. But again, this is Mises going to the heart of the matter. And to him, the heart of the matter is violence and also violence against property. Of course, against the individual, but also against that extension of the individual property. This is the most important, maybe the most important element of his teaching on this whole issue. And you can read Rothbard on this. You can read Hans Hermann Hoppe about time preference and property and the regard of the protection of property and the extension of the self from property. And this goes right throughout the whole liberal movement, the classical liberal movement. So very, very important comments here, and very important explanations for what's happening in the 1920s. This one final point, in light of all the violence and totalitarianism and inflationary plunder and all of it, I want to say this. And it's, I've been working on these themes for quite a while now in my life, and on the themes of the violence of the Nazis, the violence of the Bolsheviks, the whole extension of the war, the whole brutality of the war, and all that. And the amazing thing is, to me, and in a sense, one of the more important parts of the story is that the individual survived. I mean, in the end, in spite of everything, the individual survived. So I've brought back the sound, the word cloud. Some of you know this from other courses. You can do this too. You can go online a couple of different places and make a word cloud. And so I just, you know, we talked last week about a list of individualists of different stripes from the 1920s who really flourished in this horrible period of statism and socialism and cruelty and brutality, and people who were really life-affirming individualists of all kinds. And so I just stuck these names together and made a sound, a word cloud of it, sorry, not a sound cloud, and made a word cloud, and it took the names apart and put them in different places. But I thought, well, that's fun too, because you can kind of stick the names back together in your head. And you, I really do hope that on the forum this week, somebody will help me add to this. I mean, I think we have to say it's going to be people who are old enough, you know, born before the turn of the century, who in the wake of the war come to their powers as individuals. And so, you know, I've included people like the great black novelist Zora Neale Hurston, Tolkien I include in there, Ayn Rand is in there, Mises, Fritz Machlup, you get the picture. So anyway, help me expand that, and we'll make a bigger word cloud for for next week. But I really enjoy these things. Anyway, another thing, and I mentioned this, I talked a little bit about it last week, maybe, but I certainly went in some detail into this in the World War I course, and that is that even in the depth of the war, even in the most depersonalizing, dehumanizing parts of the war, it's from this war that we get the what is essentially, I think, a great civilizing tool that we don't recognize very much, and that's a lot of these core children's books that came out in the 1940s and 1950s, almost all of them by people who had fought in the trenches of the Western Front. So Hugo Fielding, who wrote Dr. Doolittle, he got his idea when he saw some wounded horses and said the doctors could just talk to the horses. This is in my Western Front book. I've never seen it anywhere else. It occurred to me while I was writing the book, and so I just started looking for these authors. And, of course, you get Winnie the Pooh as a direct product of the war. You get National Velvet, which is a wonderful, a really wonderful book, and written by a woman who was a nurse on the front or just behind the front lines. You get the writer of Babar. You get the monkey Curious George, invented by H.A. Rey, who actually was a German who fought in the German trenches. So anyway, you get Tolkien, you get C.S. Lewis, all these people who later in life react to this dehumanizing war by humanizing in reverse. In other words, by going against the tide in the same way that Rivka, Mises, Hayek, and many others did. So I don't see this in a completely negative way. In other words, there's this horrific, overwhelming brutality, but I think that the individual does survive, and that we have a lot to thank these giants for. That we live in a world where we can still think about this today, we can still talk about it, we can still have this course. So that's the end of my sermon for the evening, and I thought I would just put a map of interwar Europe up here while we have our question and answer, so you'll have something nice to look at. And thank you for your patience, especially since we had that ugly period of technological problem at the first. Probably my fault some way, but in any case, let the questions roll. Let the good times roll, and we will start. We will start with the question. I'll go to the question answer line first, and then I'll run up to the chat line and work back and forth. Okay. Okay. is there a good resource to see during the Weimar hyperinflation where the government was spending the money? You know, that's not as easy as it seems, Nathan. I at one time was going to launch into a study of that, and in all the hyperinflation books, there is some about this. I think that your best bet is Gerald Feldman, and it's a huge, fat book called The Great Disorder. And I don't like the book because, as a whole, because he criticizes Mises in a very ugly way. I mean, what did Gerald Feldman know about economics? But in any case, there is some material there on what the government was spending the money on. But you have to dig. You do have to dig into it. It's one of the fatter books in the known world, I guess. So Gerald Feldman. The Great Disorder. Let me run up to the comments and okay, audio, video, book titles. Let's see. Vangelis has a comment. Provocation is common not only to the left but everywhere. One of my favorite books is Chesterton's The Man Who Would Be Thursday. In the novel, a police informant infiltrates an anarchist organization, becomes the leader of England. He is a Thursday. There are other national leaders every day of the week. As the book progresses, each leader is captured, and every one of them works for the police. And this is a quintessential part of the age of brutality, isn't it? That you have this kind of provocation. And the thing about that is, that then you don't know whether to believe somebody's real. I mean, since we know that there are provocateurs, and this day and age, many of them write books. You know, people who were provocateurs have a change of heart, and then they suddenly write books. So we know that they exist. So the question is, what about the rest of these people? Who is and who isn't? So this makes it a very tricky century to think about in that way. Let's see. Yep, we got Stephen Halbrook's book on there. Okay. Are there more questions, or did we lose everybody in the technological? Can we, since they call the storm in New York a storm vortex, a weather vortex, can we call this evening, this evening's beginning, a technological vortex? Would that be correct? Danny, I don't know if that would be correct or not, but Cam says it's good, and I think we can go with it. So we'll call this the evening of the technological vortex. I do not see Danny's not here. Well, I guess the vortex just made him just leave. So... I guess we can, it ate him. Yeah, he disappeared into the vortex. Well, he'll be missed. Okay. I haven't answered all the questions. I know that. I mean, the lecture did not answer all the questions. It was my intention to raise some questions. So I'll let you think for a minute. Where are our question askers when we need them? Aha! Thank you, Leslie. I appreciate that. A question when needed sorely. Thank you. Where did the money from the Nazis come from in the early 1920s? That's a very good question. One place it came from, and this is amazing the extent to which the money was raised this way. It came from party dues. is they set party dues really, really high. This was all on purpose. We know they're planning. We know there's a great book by Dietrich Orlo, History of the Nazi Party, where he goes into every detail of all this. And Orlo shows that they sat down and said, well, what should party dues be? And somebody said, well, I think they should be two. And somebody and they had this argument, and in the end, they opted to make the dues really expensive. I mean, they were like over 100 marks or something at a time when marks were really, you know, after the stabilization. And when marks really meant something, and people were paying like more than a week's salary, maybe 2 weeks' salary for yearly dues, which was, you know, huge, maybe not that much, but some vast amount compared to just, you know, joining some organization. And so the dues were a lot, but the argument was, if they're going to be really committed, they have to pay a lot. They have to know that it, you know, that they're in. And so the party dues, actually, since they had, you know, on the order of, you know, a couple hundred thousand members, then they really did have some money to play with there since they were all paying quite a bit. And they didn't need extensive money in those early years. But once again, because they mobilized the party members, everybody volunteered. And they had a speech in Hamburg. It was the locals who got out 3 or 4 or 5 times marching and putting up placards and beating up the opponents and kicking in the windows of their enemies and all of this stuff in planned events leading up to the speech. And then they'd, you know, harangue all their neighbors to go to the speech and do all these things to get the people there. So in essence, they weren't spending a whole lot of money. They did make some movies and all that. And they got some donations early on from businessmen. But early on, the party, a lot of businessmen avoided giving money to the Nazi Party because it seemed so left-oriented. The platform itself, as you know, is very left-oriented. It's about, you know, even the factory owners have to exercise national responsibility. So in a way, the original program was too left-oriented, and not that many rich people financed Hitler. What happened was that Hitler, after the Depression, actually after 1931-32, decided to court more of the industrialists. And so he took off his brown uniform and put on a nice double-breasted suit and went to the Dusseldorf Industrial Club and David Beach and started, you know, kind of going in the circles that modern politicians would go in. And so he got a lot of money that way. Then he went to he began to argue as the party got bigger and bigger after the Depression, then he started getting big donations from the leading industrialists, many of whom said in later years, well, yeah, we gave money to the Nazis. We gave money to every party, just in case. So it was, you know, there were so many parties who might be likely to be in a government coalition that a company like, Junkers, the airplane company, or Krupp, or German General Electric, I mean, they just gave money to everybody. So that's partly how they got their money later. But in those early years, a lot of it was dues. Let me read here. Angel Wysowski says, do other people see the same parallel between what we saw during the war and afterwards in the current situation around the world? Seems to me that the rejection of money as a commodity that limits government use of currency caused most of the problems, including the war itself, and the false idea that the war was something that future generations will pay for it, diverted attention from the capital destruction that was taking place as scarce resources were diverted for use by the military and their suppliers. I think it's exactly the same thing, Gail. I think you're exactly right, and I couldn't, not only could I not put that better, but I don't think I could put that well. So I think you're exactly right. And you know, here's a point that I was going to make when I was talking about I was going to make when I talked about the stabilization. And there's more to come on that, because you may recall that the American bankers did step in, as I mentioned very briefly, and gave loans to Germany that would back up that stabilization plan, first of the Rentenmark and then later of the Reichsmark. Well, that plan was negotiated by a Chicago banker named Dawes, William G. Dawes. And Dawes was a pal of Pershing's and a guy who, previous to the war, had become a kind of agent for British loans in Chicago. And the Morgan people in New York, and this is not backroom stuff. This is what we know from memoirs and things. The Morgan people told Dawes that if he would front for them, he would enter the big leagues. He would be at the top of the world. And so he became one of the main purchasing agents for the American Army, the ADF in Europe. And then after the war, became a commissioner for this and that, and eventually vice president and so forth and so on. Dawes was sent by the American investment banks in 1924 to carry out a loan, to offer a loan to Germany and to negotiate that, and the German railroads would be taken as the as the backing for the loan and as collateral and all that. And so what he did was to negotiate exactly that type of colonial loan that we were talking about last week in these imperial situations, the big China loans before World War One, and the Mexico loans and the Turkey loans, where they would, and the Egyptian loans, where they loaned money for railroads and then confiscated the collateral once, or repossessed the collateral once the country couldn't pay, although they knew that they were loaning so much money that the country couldn't pay. So they used exactly this kind of technique in the form of the Dawes plan. The Germans still couldn't pay, and there's a story behind that that I'll tell next week. But in 1928, then Owen Young, who was actually a member of the Morgan Bank on the board, came over to renegotiate that loan and to make it even more explicitly this kind of colonial loan. And this this was a point made by the Nazis and also by the left-wing parties. They said, wait a minute, why has Germany, now a republic, now supposedly a simpatico democracy with the rest of the West, why has Germany suddenly become this colonial being of the big bankers in New York? And of course, on the Hitler side, he said, "Yeah, those big bankers. Well, they're most of them Jews anyway, because they're just front people for the Rothschild." So everybody interpreted that light. And then the far left Germans said, "Oh, the loans are come from this hyper-capitalist and the, you know, the real secret run the managers of the whole world, et cetera, et cetera." But that was the state of things. It was these big bankers who saw the opportunity for the Germans to do this. There was also this aspect of it. The Dawes loans and the Young loans envisioned this. They went to Germany. So it's from New York to Germany. The Germans, in the minds of the New York crowd, would then turn around and take those loans and pay reparations to Britain, France, and Belgium. All right? That's the plan. And then Britain, France, and Belgium would turn around and pay those loans back to the banks in New York. See what I mean? And then every time that money passes through the coffers of the New York banks, then it goes cha-ching, you know, and they charge another fee on it. And then it flows back to Germany and it circulates that way. That's the idea. And it worked that way for a little while. But the problem is, again, the Weimar Republic was the most perfect democracy. And I mean that in the worst way and the best way. In other words, in the worst way, it became totally interest politics. Every party wanted some little thing for its own. Every party had its eye on somebody else's money. Everybody wanted in this, you know, this rent-seeking behavior just went wild. And so every party that was in office tried to give something to somebody so that they could get votes, so that they could keep influence. So, for example, if you needed votes in Flensburg, then promise people that you'll dredge the harbor. And you spend a lot of that, again, loans from America, you say, well, you know, we can spend a few hundred thousand dredging the harbor. Another place has done you a favor, or you want them to vote for you, or you need popping up in the electoral district, and you say, well, they need a new slaughterhouse there, let's build it. Or an auditorium. You know what? Also, the socialists said, what is needed in this country is a sport for the working class to do. And the working class, you know, they don't have money to ride horses or play tennis, but what they can do is swim. And so the socialist government built swimming pools in all over Germany. I don't know, some huge percentage of the loans coming from the Morgan Bank and its other banks in the consortium in New York went to build swimming pools in Germany. So you get down the road, and the Germans haven't paid much of the reparations debt. They still say, "Oh, we're too poor to pay those," but they've been using them in this. Social democratic welfare state. So that's an important part of the story. Okay. That was a long answer to actually what was not even a question, but oh well. Rodney Huff to all participants. No, Brad Skiles. Sorry. Well, Vangel is talking to Kim about something. So given the level of violence, Brad asks, how were the people prepared for this? Was the moral basis or religious foundation altered in some way to dehumanize war? I think that started before the war, Brad. I think that the moral base had been altered somewhat, but certainly the religious institutions of Europe were fighting for members and fighting for relevance and fighting for a lot of things. I think at some level Europeans were maybe a majority were still believers of some kind or another. But so much of the war was impacted people in a way that later on the Holocaust would impact a lot of people who said, no, that's just so horrible. I can't believe that God would let these kinds of things happen. And so they lost their faith and whatnot. But as for the moral aspects of this, again, I mean, if you get into the habit of these, horrific acts of brutality on the battlefield, then, and if you get in the habit of being cheated by your government and seeing your money flow away, and it's not even the government again. Inflation is a very silent kind of theft. But you see it at the bakers. You know, you get mad at the baker, and so you start to hate him because the bread prices went up. You think you did it, or the meat prices went up. You blame the butcher. Remember that I showed a picture last week of a butcher shop that had been looted. So again, you know, things. People were in need and in want, and they just kept on saying, well, morally speaking, this is right. I'll just loot this butcher shop. That's wrong because it wasn't the butcher who had done it. But I think there are all these kinds of things at work. Plus, the whole issue of eat, drink, be merry, tomorrow we die. In other words, you have a extremely urgent time preference. You have to consume it now. You can't delay gratification, and there's no point in delaying gratification because if you do, you won't have the money will be worthless where it's just a little bit today. So that'd be my answer to that. That's a good question. Rodney says, "What's your opinion of Jan's?" Do you think his turn against Rhodes and the British was authentic, or was his sudden defection a ruse to fool the Boers into letting a British agent into their military ranks? That's a good question. And I don't know the specifics about, I've read about this kind of thing. You know, there's one of my blog entries is about Smuts, and you can read more about what I think of him there. I think he was a Boer leader, who just thought, I think he became a kind of, I think he was very ambitious, and he wanted to play a role in the larger world. I mean, in general, and I think that he was always on the lookout for something to do that would be memorable and make him famous in later life. And in the end, he elbowed his way into the peace conference, and he was crucial to many of the international activities of the period between the wars. And I think he hooked himself up with a lot of people who would be considered kind of financial insiders, and in the same attempt to kind of rub shoulders with the great and the powerful. So I don't know. I mean, he was certainly, I don't say two-faced, let's say malleable, from the time he was pretty young. I mean, to be a Boer commander in the commander of commandos in the Boer War, and then go into the British administration, that tells you something about him to begin with. So that'd be my general opinion. He was a guy who became great, but I think he became great partly because he felt like he was destined for greatness and you know, shaped his path to achievement. So let me go down to the questions on the bottom, because I've ignored Nathan's for quite a while now. I haven't finished reading Exchange Prices and Production in Hyperinflation in Germany or The Economics of Inflation, but so far they seem almost like the same book. Do you mean the Bresciani-Turoni book? And I'm trying to think what the other book is, Nathan. Can you remind me? Nathan's other question is, am I going to get into the Irish Civil War? Yeah, if I had time to mention, I would have mentioned it. Frank Graham. I think, let me go back to the books. I think that Bresciani-Turoni's arguments are more Misesian. But I do think that they're quite similar books. I mean, they obviously are presenting the same roughly the same statistics and things. They do seem very similar. Yeah. My impression is by the economists, and remember, I'm a historian, but by the economists, the great Austrians who evaluate these books, these two books, I think. My sense of it is that the Bresciani-Turoni is the favorite book. Irish Civil War. I was going to get into it at some point, and probably if I'd had time, I would have continued on tonight into that. But it's a kind of analog of all these things. The Irish problem is a much longer term problem than even many on the continent. Goes all the way back to basically the first English disruption of the Irish of Irish autonomy and the Irish system is right after the Norman invasion, and it was intensified by the Tudors and the Stuarts, and by the time you get to the 20th century, the hatred that's built up. Of the English for of the tendency of the English to disrespect and dislike the Irish and to be suspicious of them as Catholics, that's a terrible thing. And then, of course, that the whole history of those plantations in the northern four counties that that increased the problem, because the favored Protestant minority that had been moved over, the Scots Irish and the people who mixed in with them, that made problems even worse. So in England, on the eve of the war, you know, people were worried about the coming catastrophe, but to them it was a civil war in Ireland. But in the end, as you know very well, the two units, two of the first volunteer units formed were the Protestant Northern Ireland unit and the volunteers in the South who had been about to fight the Northern Ireland unit. And so they formed up divisions and went off and fought the war together. But in the wake of the war, Lloyd George is at Paris agreeing, after a while with Wilson, that they'd have to let self-determination happen in Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia. And yet he's fighting a brutal war at home to maintain a control of Northern Ireland. I mean, that's the crux of it. They've just about decided by 1920, 21, 22 that they'll let, well, in 22 for sure, that they'll let the rest of Ireland go, but they're going to keep the north. And so there is that horrific, ugly violence that then crops up again in Northern Ireland in the 60s and the 70s and finally starts settling down in the 80s. And let's hope it's gone for it's gone for good in the horrible ways that it existed there then. But if we think about the Easter Rising in that context that I've just mentioned, it is a move for independence. But on the other hand, you've also got to admit that nearly all those risers in Dublin were socialists, romantic socialists. I mean, not very Marxist. They were more a little more romantic, a little more individual, but they were most of them socialist. But on the other hand, they were for the independence of their country and secession. So I like the secession part of it. I don't like the socialist part so much. So I guess I'm on two minds on that. But it's certainly a conflict that fits right into our violence, our violent 20th century kind of a thing. Of course, Ireland became Northern Ireland became a country in 1920, the course of 23, and was independent and well out of the British Empire. But in any case, that'd be my answer to that. Yeah, it's a topic, and maybe we'll deal with it in some different ways as we go along as well. That's a good question, Nathan. Thank you. So Vangel, and I hope I'm saying that right, it says, is there a decent critique to, you say Weiser, I think you mean Weiser's analytical framework and the problems that caused for monetary theory within the Austrian school. It seems to me that his argument that money has a natural cardinal value has caused a lot of problems. Cam, you may know something about that. Somebody else in the class probably knows. I don't know where that critique would be. I agree that this is not a good thing, and for money to have a natural cardinal value goes against what modern Austrians agree to. So somebody else in the class may have a good idea where that is. Leslie says, were there any classical liberals or parties in any of the European states at this period? Well, Leslie, this is the main problem, that this whole period had kind of overwhelmed everybody, even before the war. The Liberal Party in England, which had been a kind of classical liberal party, not totally classical liberal. We discussed this in the preceding weeks about whether Gladstone was a liberal or not, but that's the Liberal Party. And they had, in some sense, their hearts in the right place, many of them. But in the period 1910 to 1912, they just all became nationalists imperialists, social imperialists. They just converted over. Lloyd George, the wartime leader and the man at the Paris Peace Conference, was largely responsible for this shift. And what he did was to institute an income tax and carry out the usual reforms that we've understood to be part of parliamentary and democratic government of the 20th century. So a lot of the liberal parties caved. I'll tell you, of all the pre-war parties that stuck up for something, I would say the Canadian liberals stuck up the most, and we'll have to deal with their history at a little bit different time. But I'd say the Canadians, there's a whole story there that I won't go into, but I'd say they had won, and it kind of got overwhelmed during the war on the issue of conscription. After the war, if we look around, the Austrians didn't really have a classical liberal party. The Germans had so many parties in that Weimar system, and it was a proportional representation system, so a lot of parties could get a proportion of the parliament. And there were actually a couple of parties that I would say were in the area classical liberal. There was the precursor of the current FDP in Germany. One of the precursors was a party called the DDP, the German Democratic Party, Deutsche Demokratische Partei, which was against aggression in foreign policy. It was for fairly laissez-faire society, and it was for moderating nationalists. It was actually a pretty good party. A man named Eric Koch, K-O-C-H, Weser, hyphen Weser, W-E-S-E-R, was one of the leaders of that party, and I like him really well. Also, a man named Friedrich Naumann, a famous German intellectual, and a man known as a German liberal, a person who appears in Ralph Rako's book on the liberal parties in Germany from the earlier period. Naumann was a member of the DDP and so forth. And what happened to the DDP was what happened to many parties in Germany after the Depression hit, and that was they all, since it became a competition for interests, so they called that interest politics, every party got smaller and smaller little ideas about what their interest was. And the DDP split into two different parties, one called the State Party, the Staatspartei, and the other was called the Wirtschaftspartei, the Economic Party. And that Economic Party was actually a pretty decent party. I mean, I guess if I'd been in the DDP and it split, I would have gone with that Economics Party. But by that time, by the late 20s, those parties had a certain less and less influence. But Friedrich Naumann, N-A-U-M-A-N-N, and Eric Koch Weser would be people who, by and large, you wouldn't mind, going to hear a speech from them or something. And Naumann died for the Nazi period, but Koch Weser immigrated to Brazil. I mean, all these people were like Mises. People of that ilk were, in large measure, run off or went to ground what the Germans call inner immigration. And they just, stayed home and kept a low profile and got under the radar. So that would be a party. In France, really not much. The old Radical Party had become thoroughly hyper-national. And in Poland, there was not much in the way of a liberal party. I mean, I just range over these different countries, and there's not much there. There's not much there. For the German case, though, for everybody, I do recommend, for the earlier period, the pre-war period, I do recommend Ralph Rako's superb book, Party of Freedom, about the Liberal Party in Germany. from an earlier period, which sets up the DDP and later parties. So I certainly can recommend that. Let's see. Let me go back to the questions down on the question answer. Nathan says, is there a good book on how the Catholic Church was changing during this time or throughout the 20th century, or the Orthodox Church in Russia? I don't know of one right off the bat, Nathan. Maybe somebody in the class will have a good one on that. I mean, the Orthodox Church was changing in Russia mainly because it was shut down during war communism and then opened up as a kind of a fake church in many ways afterward, all run by the KGB or the predecessors to the KGB. But yeah, I don't know. If somebody has a good book that they know of on those subjects, please speak up. Rodney Huff says, when Bresciani Tironi talks about the flight from the mark, does his analysis remind you of Robert Hooke's idea of regime uncertainty? Oh, yeah. See page 54 where he talks about the loss of confidence and the fear of heavy taxes. Yeah, the loss of property rights. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and who wouldn't? I mean, if oftentimes this whole thing is pictured as if it was only unscrupulous people who wanted to protect their money. Like the moral thing to do would have been just to stick with it and ride it out and get your bundles of marks and you know, use them for the fireplace or something. But of course, you know, you could, you know, try to do anything to, to ride that thing out. But it was, of course, extraordinarily hard to do that under the circumstances. And remember, this is Europe that's all becoming more nationalistic. And so at this, during inflation years, Germans had a very difficult time moving money anywhere. In other words, you could say, well, why don't they put it in Switzerland? It's just next door. But moving money was already a highly regulated activity in Germany and Austria, even during the First World War. And many of these regimes kept tabs on that and, had ways of knowing about bank deposits and international movement of currency and whatnot. So, yeah, that's a pretty it's really to the point. And I like your comparison to Higgs's regime uncertainty. I agree. Cam, I'm not sure what to ask of Bob Murphy and David Gordon, but I'd ask anything of either of them. There's the Party of Freedom book. Wait, it's only in Germany or in German or not? I forget. Yeah, it's in English now. It's in English now. I remember. It's in English now. Okay. Well, look, guys. Any more questions? We still have. At least in my telling of it, we still have 14 participants here. I don't see any more questions. Let me see. Oh, okay. Well, are we slowing down? I mean, we got a late start. We've been going about not quite 2 hours because we really didn't get started until about 10 till 5 because of the technological vortex. So what do you think? Are we finished tonight or is there more to talk about? And we will I'll consult. Well, thank you, Leslie. I appreciate it. Thanks for your good question. I will consult with Danny next time or and Cam and see if we can get all this sorted out ahead of time. I don't know. I had exactly the same setup as before, but maybe I'll talk with him in the meantime, and I apologize for all that. I don't know why it happened, but we'll try to figure it out. Thank you, Brad. Good to see you on here. Thanks very much. Thanks for your questions. And I guess that's it. So everybody, good night. Thanks for attending. Thanks for participating. Get out there. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it. Everybody, Tom reminds me that we have this forum, and I'll be grading your essays as soon as I can. The second essay, the second week's essay is out there, and some of you may have sent it in already, but I'll get on that very soon. Thanks, Rodney. Thanks for your good questions. Appreciate it. I'm really happy all of you are doing this course, and I'm glad you're participating. So let's call it a night, and I will say goodnight. So see you next week. Bye-bye.